BBC World Service presents The World Today. Vietnam, the failure to communicate.
The concept of society under which we function calls for a complete open society, complete access to information. I think any effort to hold back information is an illusion today. We're simply too exposed.
That was Barry Zorthian, American Consular for Public Affairs in Saigon, responsible for the last 4 years for the Civilian and Military Public Information Service. On his recent return from this post, he was interviewed by James Mossman, a journalist who has himself made many visits to Vietnam. Mossman asked Mr. Zorthian what difference he saw between his own job and that of the on-the-spot newspaper correspondents.
I've always felt my job in Vietnam was twofold. One was to make the facts available as we've known them. Second, to transmit our evaluation of those facts, our judgments based on those facts. Correspondent's role is to review those. Literally to judge whether the facts we have are correct. Whether there are other facts or other dimensions of those facts that we haven't taken into account. And two, if you will, to pass judgment on our judgment. Now, when the effort functions well, there's mutual respect and recognition of these two roles. As you're well aware, we have had differences with the press in Vietnam, but I also think we've had a dialogue with the press. And while obviously we haven't reached agreement, I don't think the coverage has been quite as one-sided or quite as negative as it is always made out to be.
Is that, once was said to me in one of my many visits to Saigon, that the virtue and device of American officials like yourself there was that if they could persuade you to stay in Saigon, you would then accept their version of the facts. But then when you decided you wouldn't stay in Saigon, they would make every effort to help you go and see for yourself. There seems to be a slightly schizoid approach to the subject.
Now, they've frequently been accused of a gap between the situation on the spot and what's been said in Saigon, and I suppose some of this is inevitable. There is a gap.
Why is it inevitable?
Because a military headquarters, receives only a limited amount of information from its subordinate echelons. What finally ends up at headquarters at MACV will be only the barest bones. I should explain that the term MACV stands for the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, which is the overall American military headquarters in the country.
Now, I'm very confused always about the assessment of casualties, of Viet Cong casualties. I've actually had these wild, these grand, incredible figures given to me.
And MACV's figures are not pulled out of thin air, nor are they made up in the J3's operations office. They are a compilation of the figures that come from subordinate units. You start with the frontline platoon who has to do his daily report, and that platoon commander puts in a figure, X, we have killed 10 VC today. Those figures gradually move up the pyramid, and all MACV literally does is add them up and issue them, which is one of the reasons for these precise figures, 123 VC dead today.
But you say that your job is also to interpret information.
Well, you will find, I think, in the ground rules issued in November of 1966, a statement to correspondents that all casualty estimates are simply the best estimate that can be undertaken under the existing military situation. Now, we're in no position, and certainly not in Saigon, to go down and double-check every platoon commander or every company commander on the front line.
But that means that in the end, at the end of, say, a week's body counting, if somebody says to you, are you really in a position to say how many BC were killed this week or not?
All we can say is we know the figures that represent the best estimates of our field commanders.
Well, that's dead bodies, but not necessarily dead Viet Cong bodies.
Well, this, you are giving an almost impossible task. The battlefield count presumes that the bodies in that battlefield consist of participants, of combatants.
But I've seen Marines take out a village, and I've seen, you know, the results are often sometimes boys of 10 who actually couldn't have been VC.
Well, boys of 10
I'm aware
could
that boys
be,
of 10
could
have
be VC.
But in particular cases near Da Nang, they weren't.
I'm sure there have been cases of error and misjudging, but On the other hand, the VC used unarmed porters to carry ammunition into battle. Men and women of all ages, ones who aren't of fighting military age. If they're killed in the middle of battle, do you count them as VC or don't you? The VC are not always a uniformed army in the conventional sense. The North Vietnamese tend to be, and the VC very often all have black pajamas on, but the black pajama also happens to be the dress of the peasant.
Exactly.
How do you distinguish between them? These are extremely difficult things, and the frontline commander is again expected to distinguish between them to make an estimate, but I'm sure errors have been made, and there's an instinctive, a natural tendency on the part of battlefield commanders, if you will, to inflate their figures.
Well, also, if their own men's lives were in danger, they would take priority over about who the enemy was.
I'm sure they would. I've always been against the concept of body count. I wish I had a magic wand and willed the phrase away. I'd also remind you that the phrase and the practice started in response to questions from correspondents back in 63-64 who questioned casualty figures and said, have Americans counted these bodies? And we finally got into that horrible practice of using such a phrase.
Can you tell me, in the case of the great siege, as it came to be called, of Khe Sanh, in which the Marines were holed up and were apparently about to be plastered into obliteration by artillery from the enemy, this was presented to the world by the Americans as a place which must be held and could be held as a vital place and as a major issue, militarily. Then, when the publicity had died down, suddenly we found that you had pulled out. This seemed to be, information-wise, a great contradiction.
Well, it did present an information problem, but I've never been one to believe the information problems ought to overrule the substantive issues, and particularly not on the battlefield. You can argue with General Westmoreland's strategy, and this has been done. I think the military command's thinking on Khe Sanh was that early in the game, when its troops and forces in I Corps were limited, that its best defense lay in a defensive line along the DMZ.
Would you say, as an expert in information, that the method by which a much more astral level of people in Washington presented the case was confusing and unfortunate?
I think so. It would have been desirable and easy to say in January, someday we're going to pull out of this base and undertake a mobile defense. We still intend to deny this territory to the enemy, but we believe we can do it better by not being tied down to this single plot of ground. However, this also telegraphs your punches, your strategic moves. And it's the type of information the enemy would have loved to have had. Here was a situation where security considerations very definitely restrained what might have been the desirable information approach.
What about the successive general statements from Saigon on the non-military side to the effect that the Minds and Hearts campaign or the village reconstruction campaign, or what it happened to be at the time, was effecting its objectives, that the people were on the side of the established government and that this was being demonstrated. Year after year, this has proved not necessarily to be true.
I think you will find that in our announcements of Hamlet evaluation system figures, we have said constantly that all these figures represent is our judgment as to control, as to security. We do not attempt to climb into people's minds and say control or security is equivalent to positive commitment on the part of a population. We've tried to judge control and security by a set of measurable yardsticks. Has there been an attack in that village? Has a certain organization been established? Has the infrastructure been eliminated? Now, there's an implication that if you start a school or put in a midwife facility or provide IRA rice or what have you, that this will create a positive attitude on the parts of people. But that is not an element in our measurement.
But you infer that.
It's an inference that very often is made by correspondents rather than us. These figures do not purport to show the degree of support for the government. They simply show the areas, the population, that we believe the government controls, and in various categories, some day and night, some most of the time, some only partially of the time, some not at all. I think it's all virtually impossible to measure the degree of support in the terms you're talking about in the hearts and minds area.
Yes, but if the crux of the American position in Vietnam is that they represent what they claim to be the will and interests of the people, which is the general claim at one level.
Yes.
Where, in your case, does the job start of demonstrating that to people like me? Isn't that one of your briefs?
Well, the sine qua non of the effort is provision of security. Once having provided security, other things can't flow from it. You then have an opportunity to undertake a program in the countryside or in the cities. And out of that, hopefully, would flow a degree of support and commitment to a government. And I would make very few hard claims about support of the government. A good deal would depend on which portion of the population you're talking to. I think one of the generalizations that's least valid in Vietnam is a statement the Vietnamese think that. Are you talking about the peasant? Are you talking about people in the provincial populated areas, the provincial capitals? Are you talking about the urban worker? Are you talking about the intellectual, the civil servant, the military man, the businessman? These are all fairly separate groups within Vietnam, and all with somewhat different attitudes.
But it makes your job extremely difficult, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I have never believed, nor do I today, that the picture in Vietnam is black and white, that you can speak in absolutes. This has been part of our problem. The picture is a series of grays with a great deal of room for judgment. You can agree pretty much on facts if you sit down and thrash out, but what those facts mean has been a constant source of differences.
Since you're coming to the end of your tour in Vietnam, going back to America, are you depressed by the fact that a lot of Americans, very articulate ones, are saying that because of American involvement in Vietnam, which to some extent they disapprove of, America is tied. She cannot make moral judgments or statements about the activities of other powers, like, say, the Russians in their attack on Czechoslovakia?
Well, I am seeing at this stage a full range of American comments, so I don't know how widespread that kind of reaction is. But if there is any of it, and particularly from knowledgeable Americans, then I am disappointed. In Vietnam, we had the case of an established government threatened by aggression from the outside, calling for assistance under the very well-accepted concept of self-defense. This was not what happened in Prague, as I understand it. The Czechoslovak government did not ask, or so it says, so the broadcasts say, for help from the Soviets and from the other Warsaw Pact nations. And this is an essential difference in justification.
One, some people would argue you're making a technical distinction.
I would argue it's not technical. It's the most basic distinction they can have. I've always said that I think to a great extent we failed in communicating the war in Vietnam, that it has not been communicated well to the American people. I think the government's at fault here, and I think there's been a parallel failure, if I may say, by the press in its broadest sense. I certainly see a tremendous distinction on a base of morality or any other yardstick you want to apply.
You've been listening to Barry Zorkian, American public affairs officer in Saigon since 1964. The interviewer was James Mossman. And this is your narrator, Neil Landor, reminding you that there'll be another edition of The World Today in the BBC World Service tomorrow.